What Kim wants to show is that he could go to China and have China invest in North Korea as opposed to the United States or South Korea.
Korea, China, and trade dominate the focus of U.S. officials visiting Beijing. It's Wednesday, January 9th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a Saudi teen is in Thailand seeking asylum. Somalia reels in Chinese fishing. The business of ice, rhino horns, and tuna. Recycled fuel and new gadgets. It's all on today's VOA Asia. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Beijing this week, his fourth visit in less than a year. The trip comes as Chinese and U.S. officials held a second day of trade talks and as Kim prepares for a second possible meeting with President Donald Trump. Analysts say the visit is likely to be an opportunity for the two countries to discuss North Korea's plans for another meeting with Trump. When the two met for the first time last March, they agreed to communicate more with each other about domestic and international affairs. China's Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un held three summits last year before and after meetings with Trump and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. Harry Kazianis is the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest in Washington. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Kazianis what he believes to be the chief reason for the North Korean leader's visit to Beijing.
One word, leverage. What Kim wants to do is he wants to show Donald Trump, but I also think the entire world, that he does have another option, that he does have, quote-unquote, a new way, as he actually mentioned in his recent speech on New Year's Day, that he doesn't need the United States if negotiations either at a summit or just generally don't go well when talking about Kim's nuclear weapons program. What Kim wants to show is that he could go to China and have China invest in North Korea as opposed to the United States or South Korea or getting sanctions lifted, which is something China can do. Because we have to remember, 90% of North Korea's exports go through China. And it's actually China is the one who enforces the United States' maximum pressure policy. So for Kim, this is a very important visit.
How does this mesh in with the trade talks that are going along, which, by the way, have been extended for another day, we understand?
Well, I think for Xi Jinping, he wants to show Donald Trump that he has his very own North Korea card to play. I think what she wants to show the entire world is if those negotiations don't go well, he could very well unleash North Korea. And that could mean basically weakening the sanctions to such an extent that the maximum pressure policy is basically ancient history. So I think for Xi, he wants Donald Trump to know that he has leverage over him. And I think that's important. And I think that's why this summit is happening now.
In the past, China has at least verbally tried to separate politics and economics. You think they're still going to do that?
I don't think anymore. I think with the Chinese economy slowing down and Xi Jinping not really being able to, at least until this point, being able to make all of the structural changes that he wanted in the Chinese economy, I think he realizes that he needs to get every piece of leverage on the United States that he can. And I think that's why Kim is in Beijing right now. And I think it's also why that Xi is really trying to extend these talks, trying to get the best bargain he can. And I think eventually there will be a bargain here that's going to be hatched. I think both sides, Washington and Beijing, are both suffering from these trade talks, but it's, you know, we're going to have to see how it plays out. But I am optimistic.
How do you think the U.S. is handling this and should be handling it if they should be doing something else in your mind?
In terms of North Korea or China?
Let's try North Korea first, then we'll go to China.
Well, U.S. foreign policy when it comes to North Korea is very much a mixed bag at this point. I think nobody in the administration and no U.S. president wants to admit the obvious. North Korea is a bona fide nuclear power with at least 20 nuclear warheads that could probably kill millions of people around the world. But the United States continues to insist on a unilateral policy where North Korea would somehow give up all its nuclear weapons. I think anybody who's looked at this issue realizes that's probably not going to happen anytime soon, or it's months, years, maybe decades away. So I think for the Trump administration, they need to figure out a way where they can have a better relationship with North Korea, where North Korea does not test ICBMs and nuclear weapons anymore, and they craft some sort of long-term relationship to make sure that we never go back to the days of fire and fury in 2017. I do think that's something Kim wants as well, because he wants the sanctions lifted. So I do see a grand bargain that could be hatched here, but the question is, can the United States back off this unilateral policy where Kim gives up all his nuclear weapons before he gets sanctions removed? I'm not really sure, but I think that's where things stand with North Korea. In terms of China, I think for China, China is extremely concerned that the United States has adopted a policy of essentially containment, essentially what brought down the Soviet Union, you know, back in the late 1980s. And I think what they're trying to do is to show Donald Trump they do have a North Korea card to play, that they could unleash Kim if they really want to, and hopefully that'll get the United States to back off these very tough trade negotiations. And I think they will.
Well, that's your prediction there. What is your prediction for the immediate future as far as the U.S. and North Korea are concerned?
Well, I think there's going to be some tough times ahead. I do think there's going to be a summit, but I think if both sides are realistic with what can be accomplished, and I think they look to history as a guide, I think we have to remember things like the Cold War, better relations between, let's say, the United States and the Soviet Union, they didn't happen over one summit or two summits. It took multiple summits. It took years for, say, Reagan and Gorbachev to develop a better relationship. And any time you have an adversarial relationship between two countries that's gone on for decades, it's going to take time for that to get better. So I think for analysts and pundits on television who say, oh, this has been a failure, I'm not ready to call it a failure yet. I think if we're patient and I think both sides understand what it's going to take to reach a grand bargain, I think we can get there. But I think the only thing that's really going to fix this is time, but also trust built between both sides. And I don't think we have that trust yet. But I think if we have multiple summits, if the North Koreans will actually meet with U.S. officials in mid-level talks, which is something they haven't done yet, those are the people who would actually craft a bargain, I think we can get to a deal. But both sides have to be willing to compromise. That's the key.
Harry Kazianis is the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest in Washington. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Meanwhile, the United States and China will continue trade talks in Beijing for an unscheduled third day. That's according to a member of the U.S. delegation on Tuesday, as the world's two largest economies look to resolve their bitter trade dispute. The meetings this week are the first face-to-face talks since U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed in December to a 90-day truce in a trade war that has roiled global financial markets. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find when you visit voanews.com. North Korea's Kim visits Beijing amid U.S.-China trade talks. U.S. expresses optimism about trade talks with China. Saudi teen safe in Thailand for now. Indonesia to resume search for crashed Lion Air Jet's voice recorder. Chinese scientist criticized for risking gene-edited babies' lives. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories with video and lots of pictures, much more as well, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Authorities in Thailand have allowed a Saudi woman held in Bangkok at the airport to leave under the care of the United Nations Refugee Agency while she seeks asylum in a third country. The 18-year-old woman arrived to Thailand from Kuwait Saturday and was detained by the Thai authorities at the airport in Bangkok and was slated for deportation to Kuwait. She was released to the UNHCR after an international outcry amid concerns that her life would be in danger if she was returned to Saudi Arabia. VOA's Latika Hoke has more details.
The Saudi woman apparently escaped her family during a vacation in Kuwait by boarding a plane for Thailand with the intention of reaching Australia. She says when she arrived in Bangkok, her travel documents were taken away from her. The Thai authorities detained her with the intention of returning her to Kuwait. She barricaded herself in her hotel room, from which she sent desperate calls for help.
My name is Rahaf, and I'm still in the room. I have no choice. They said I have to go tomorrow, and no one can help me right now.
A senator from Australia is calling for urgent action to get the young woman to Australia.
This is an opportunity for us to show genuine compassion and to stand by our principles as a free, fair and decent society, one which upholds democracy and individual freedoms.
Rights activists say for women in Saudi Arabia, fleeing the family can be a matter of life and death.
If she is sent back to Saudi Arabia, to her family, they will have essential impunity to abuse her, to inflict honor-related violence against her. And Saudi Arabia has a very poor track record in investigating and prosecuting these kind of cases.
The United Nations Refugee Agency is being urged to help the runaway.
Today, UNHCR told me they will take 5 days to consider her asylum application and 5 days to make travel arrangements to a third country.
Saudi women are assigned a male relative as a guardian even when they're adults, and they cannot make their own decisions. If they rebel, they can be severely punished or even killed without real access to legal protection.
She is a symbol of resistance, that as a young woman, she no longer wants to be dictated and controlled by the male hierarchy. The patriarchy of the society, whether it be in the religion or the politics or in the society.
In a similar case in 2017, another young Saudi woman was intercepted in the Philippines while trying to flee to Australia. She was returned to her family in Saudi Arabia, and her fate since then remains unknown. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross says Beijing and Washington could reach a trade deal that, quote, we can live with, as officials from the world's two largest economies resume talks in a bid to end their trade dispute. Ross says immediate trade issues would be the easiest to tackle. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Starting this month, Chinese fishing vessels are allowed to exploit the open waters off the Somali coast following the granting of licenses by Somalia's government last month. Somali authorities say the permits will reduce illegal foreign fishing and help boost the economy. But Somali fishermen think different. They worry the Chinese vessels now have the license to dominate the trade. Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia has a 3,300-kilometer coastline, the longest on the African mainland. For decades, the impoverished nation has struggled to protect its rich coastal waters from unlawful foreign fishing. Somalia in January began one solution to the invasive ships, the official licensing of 32 Chinese fishing boats. Umar Abshiro, Somalia's deputy minister for fisheries.
Since there had been rampant illegal fishing activities in our water by foreign countries, we're trying to mitigate this issue by legalizing the fishing so that there would be no need for them to keep looting.
Foreign fishing trawlers have long dominated Somali waters, but most operate illegally or with fake permits sold by corrupt officials. Abshiro says the official fees from Chinese fishing alone will each year earn the country over $2 million. But local fishermen like 40-year-old Musa Mao worry the Chinese now have license to dominate the trade.
We were already suffering from massive illegal fishing by foreigners, and now here we go again, as our government licenses foreign companies, who are better equipped and have more modern fishing systems than what we have, to compete with us.
Somali authorities say they will protect small-scale fishermen like Mao by closely monitoring what the Chinese catch and not allowing them to operate too close to the coast. But the chairman of Somalia's fishing association, Hassan Roble, doubts the government will be able to control the Chinese ports.
We've been informed that those vessels will be targeting the tuna fish in particular. We're concerned that those vessels will be violating our exclusive economic zone, thus resulting in direct economic conflict with our fishing communities.
It was conflict with foreign fishing boats a decade ago that led some Somali fishermen to become pirates, hijacking ships for ransom. Piracy has since declined with foreign naval patrols and as ships added security. The newly permitted Chinese fishing boats are also expected to be armed. Mohamed Shahnoor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Coming up, a huge tuna and ice sculptures bring in big money. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, Indonesia will launch a renewed search effort to find the cockpit voice recorder from a Lion Air jet that crashed into the Java Sea in October. The crash was the world's first of a Boeing 737 MAX jet and the deadliest of 2018, killing all 189 people on board. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, ice, rhino horns, and tuna are big business in Asia, not necessarily in that order, and not all legal, as we hear in today's VOA Asia's business scene with Skylar Ogden.
The International Ice and Snow Festival has just kicked off in China's Heilongjiang province. The northern ice city of Harbin has gained international attention because of the festival, a one-month-long event that draws crowds for its dramatic ice sculptures, winter competitions, and 3D light displays. The city made a total revenue of around $17 billion in 2017, receiving more than 77 million tourists. Much of that revenue comes from the festival, which increases consumption, creates jobs, and stimulates the local economy. The annual Ice and Snow Festival runs through February and costs $48 to attend. In India's eastern state of West Bengal, a rhino horn and an elephant tusk were seized by officials this week. Three Bhutanese nationals were smuggling the illegal items to Kathmandu, where they planned to sell them. Horns can get up to $10,000, and wildlife experts say demand for them is soaring in China and Southeast Asian countries. The endangered animals are found mostly in eastern India and neighboring Nepal. A large number of rhinos live amid the muddy ponds and tall elephant grass of Assam's Kaziranga National Park, a World Heritage Site which is home to more than 1,800 rhinos. The investigation into the smuggling is still underway. Sushi restaurant owner Kiyoshi Kimura set a record at Tokyo's Toyosu Fish Market, paying $3 million for a 613-pound bluefin tuna. Kimura runs the Sushi Zenmai chain of restaurants.
I expected the tuna would be between 276,000 and 460,000, or highest 552,000, but it ended up five times more expensive.
Kimura is no stranger to paying big money for big fish. In 2013, he paid the previous record of $1.4 million for bluefin tuna. And while the self-proclaimed tuna king has held the record for paying top price for a fish for six consecutive years, he says this year he may have paid just a little too much. For VOA's business scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Beijing this week, his fourth visit in less than a year. Analysts say the visit is likely to be an opportunity for the two countries to discuss North Korea's plans for another meeting with Trump. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, ending our dependence on carbon in all of its forms, especially plastics and petroleum products, is a fairly constant endeavor of engineers and entrepreneurs. VOA's Kevin Enix reports on two recent interesting advances in the sciences of recycling plastics and also moving beyond gas-powered cars.
It seems so simple. Take some plastic and drop it into this contraption, add heat, and out comes diesel fuel and petrol that can instantly be used to run a diesel generator. Surprisingly, says inventor Christopher Kost, it is that simple.
A
kilo of plastic gives a liter of liquid. It's separated between diesel and petrol.
The team that put this device together says the goal is to keep the units small and affordable. That should allow developing countries to create fuel and help cut down on plastic waste, says François Denel of the French environmental group Earthwake.
The mission of this machine is to collect plastic waste, especially in developing countries, and to create value and jobs. We want the model to be economically sustainable so it can be duplicated more and more as time goes by.
And this is the Nexo, a new fuel cell car from Hyundai. Product manager Sylvie Chile says its only emission is clean oxygen.
To make the car run, you need oxygen and hydrogen, which in the fuel cell stack are mixed. There's a chemical reaction and that produces electricity. To get oxygen, we don't carry the oxygen on board. We use the oxygen that is contained in the air as we drive through.
But that oxygen has to be incredibly clean, so it's run through three different filters before it's used to help power the car. And then it's sent back into the atmosphere, cleaner than when it went in. The Hyundai engineers say driving 1.6 kilometers in their Nexo removes the same amount of pollution that a diesel truck puts into the atmosphere every 3.2 kilometers. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
More than 4,000 exhibitors from 155 countries are in Las Vegas this week for the Consumer Electronics Show. It's one of the year's biggest conventions for companies to show off their latest technology. Michelle Quinn got a look at some of the products that are hoping to make a splash.
Here at the Consumer Electronics Show, it seems that every activity can use a little help from technology.
And we are here at the CES to show a new product, which is the production for the bicycle.
More than 180,000 people are in town this week for the annual technology show. They come to see the latest from established big tech companies, but also from new ones. Helite from France makes airbags with sensors as protection for risky activities.
Accelerometers, gyros, and then we have a microprocessor which is analyzing the motion of the cyclist. If I fall, the sensors will detect the fall and it will send a signal to the cartridge, which is located here, and the cartridge will inflate all the airbag, front, neck, and back.
Playing with the technology on the show floor is part of the fun. But some of the excitement at CES this year is about changes to come with the new speedy 5G mobile internet networks.
CES is actually a global platform for all technology products. You know, some of the key themes that we're seeing this year is things like 5G technology, which are going to enable so much faster communications for everything from healthcare to driverless car to AI. And
in the meantime, robots show off. They can do some human work. And sensors packed into everyday objects promise to make life better.
It's using sensors and an app. 20 minutes before the wake-up time is going to warm up smoothly to help you wake up.
And augmented reality can let you see the world and yourself in a new light.
You can try on 30 shades in 30 seconds on the app.
At CES, while the star of the show is technology, human ingenuity is also on display. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Las Vegas.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on many different technology platforms, especially on the internet. iTunes and SoundCloud are great places to download our program from. You can stream our program on Facebook, VOA Asia Facebook, and at our website, voanews.com. It's also a great way to get in touch with us. Send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. You can also hear us on the radio, DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today. And of course, we send our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Zubir El-Tayeb, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.